WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Christopher Cruz. The Texas Supreme Court has blocked a ruling that would let a woman get an emergency abortion, says CBS's Michelle Miller.
A judge granted her an emergency order to end the pregnancy on Thursday, but Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton appealed the decision and argued that she had not demonstrated that she would suffer immediate and irreparable harm without an abortion. Paxton also warned the doctor and hospitals that they could be sued and prosecuted if they perform the procedure.
Many aid groups are criticizing the U.S. for blocking a call for a ceasefire in Gaza, says CBS's Bradley Blackburn.
At the U.N. in New York, the U.S. vetoed a Security Council resolution calling for an end to the fighting, the U.S. instead arguing for humanitarian pauses.
We do not support calls for an immediate ceasefire. This would only plant the seeds for the next war, because Hamas has no desire to see a durable peace.
That was Deputy U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Robert Wood. Hunter Biden is talking about the investigation of his activities.
Before the tax charges filed against him in California, presidential son Hunter Biden participated in a podcast interview with an artist friend named Moby, speaking in strong words about House Republicans and conservative media.
They have expanded it that I am, in one sense, a mastermind criminal running a global syndicate, and on the other sense, that I am a degenerate that can't tie my shoes.
The goal being, as he sees it,
they're trying to kill me, knowing that it will be a pain greater than my father could be able to handle.
Tom Foti, CBS News, Washington.
The federal appeals court has reinstated a gag order limiting what former President Trump can say about his election interference case, says CBS's Dana Jacobson.
The court upheld U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan's order, which bars Trump from making public statements about potential witnesses, lawyers, and court staff. But the panel removed Special Counsel Jack Smith from the list of protected court staff and said his status as a public figure can allow Trump to still make comments about him. Trump can also continue to claim that the case is politically motivated.
Many participants at the UN Climate Summit are calling for an end to the use of oil, coal, and gas.
It's likely, many say, a reaction to the growing momentum here for some sort of language calling for the phase out of fossil fuels in a final text. There is plenty of push for it, more than 106 nations now supported. That's more than half of the nations here. It could also show some anxiety on the part of those fossil fuel nations, OPEC, that this could be some sort of turning point against fossil fuels.
The BBC's Carl Nasman in Dubai. This is CBS News.
Make the hiring process work for you. With Indeed's end-to-end hiring solution, you can attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
Hold on to your jingle.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, some snow is possible, highs near 38 degrees. For tonight, snow likely, less than a half inch of accumulation, breezy with a low around 23. Sunny for Sunday, 31, sunshine and 35 on your Monday. For Tuesday, sunny and breezy, a high of 30. Right now, 35.
Step on up and enjoy what's on tap today. Local talk about the valley and all of Wisconsin.
In fact, it's on tap every day.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome back to this, our second hour on our Saturday morning broadcast, talking with you as always this morning about the rule of law, about government, and yes, the aspiration for justice in America. As always, taking your phone calls here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, that number 844-967-2789. And Anya and I will also solicit and welcome your questions, your inquiries. Send us notes about those things online through the Civic Media broadcast stations. Online, send us those comments, those questions. Delighted to have you participate in our discussion this morning, as always, in our first hour, spending a lot of time talking about the civics of grand juries in America. These folks who are convened privately, 26 individuals in the federal system. And yes, we had a story about one state grand jury designed for the purpose of determining whether there is probable cause to believe that crimes have been committed, and then and only then returning an indictment in the public domain charging individuals. We always, always underscore the notion that people who are indicted by a grand jury in our system, this goes back to James Madison and George Mason, all those folks establishing the right to a grand jury indictment, if at all of them presumed innocent until such time, if ever, as the government is successful in proving beyond a reasonable doubt at trial that the offense conduct charged in those criminal complaints, those grand jury indictments, has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt at the trial level. And that applies to all of the defendants that we've identified in our first hour. That includes Hunter Biden, charged with evading taxes on millions of dollars from foreign firms. That includes this retired U.S. diplomat who is accused of working as a secret agent for Cuba. It includes these four Russian soldiers with war crimes. They have been charged against an American there in Ukraine at the start of the war. It includes this Indian official who directed an assassination plot in New York against a separatist, a Sikh separatist, an attorney here in New York, advocating for the creation of a separate Sikh state in India. And yes, it also includes in the state system, six individuals coming out of Nevada charged by a grand jury there with having administered a scheme, having put together these fake electoral documents stating that they were proper electors in the state of Nevada for Donald Trump, when in fact that's false. All of them charged by the attorney general there in the state of Nevada, as the attorneys general in Michigan and Georgia have also done, criminally charging them with conduct in violation of state law. All of that also coming out of state grand jury systems, underscoring once again the great authority, of course, that prosecutors have when it comes to presenting these cases in front of the trial judges, both federal and state. But this all-important seminal notion that charges ultimately, with these limited exceptions of identifying people, getting them in custody if we need to act quickly under a complaint process, all of that focused upon relying upon the community to make the determination that probable cause has been established. Those cases pending now in America, going to trial in the coming year or years, as the federal and at least with respect to three of those cases, the state court judges schedule those on. We know that all of those trials, yes, including probably Hunter Biden's trial, will also be going on in the midst of the coming campaign. It's already underway. The two leading candidates, obviously, are the current president, Joseph Biden. And yes, it is his son, who has been indicted by a federal grand jury. That will plainly draw a lot of attention during the course of the coming campaign. And rightly so. It is news. It is news when the son of the sitting president has been indicted, as he has been in these two cases. Still important to note, as we did in our first hour, that Joe Biden himself, not at all indicted, not even mentioned, not implicated in any way directly or indirectly in those indictments. These are individual charges against Hunter Biden, the president's son, just as in these other federal cases, also likely going to trial, That is the district court, the D.C. district court case involving Donald Trump, involving election interference. There, again, a singular defendant. His name is Donald Trump. Four counts pending in the district court in the District of Columbia. That case probably going to trial sometime in the spring. Right now, Tanya Chutkan has scheduled that trial for March of 2024. And then we also have the other federal case in South Florida in front of Eileen Cannon. She is another federal judge. She right now is scheduling that matter again for May. That may or may not slip. But also another trial almost certainly happening, or at least getting some speed, moving toward the convening of a trial jury sometime in the same period of time when Donald Trump and Joe Biden are vying for the presidency. It marks for a 2024 full of politics, as is always the case during an election year, but also this year, a time when necessary focus upon rule of law and understanding what is and is not happening, the significance of evidence being presented at a trial, and the requirement that the prosecutors, whether they are state or federal prosecutors, they have the burden to show beyond a reasonable doubt in all of these cases, cases involving each one of these defendants we've talked about, the burden is upon the government to show beyond a reasonable doubt. Defense does not have to come forward with any evidence whatsoever. That is our system that we embrace, we endorse, and that animates the way in which we mete out justice in America after, of course, a jury returns a verdict. If indeed they do so unanimously in the federal system, beyond a reasonable doubt, then that assumption, that presumption of innocence goes away. The defendant then convicted, and a judgment based upon a sentencing could in fact enter. An appeal could follow that as well. And we've talked about those kinds of things in our previous broadcasts as well. All of that, we will keep very much on top of as 2023 grows into 2024. And all of this happens virtually simultaneously in the annals of American contemporary and one day historical development. All of that as a predicate to say that in the midst of this present campaign period, one of those candidates, and yes, we've talked about the other candidate as well, Joseph Biden, and we will do that down the road as well. But one of those candidates has articulated his view for the future of America. He has articulated that from his own words, the things he has said sometimes in tweets, sometimes in the public domain, often from podiums, at rallies, in interviews, in all sorts of other forums, from his own mouth, articulating what his view, what his plans are if he becomes the president of the United States of America. And in our next broadcast, Saturday, the 16th, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about the specific things that Donald Trump has said about his specific plans attributed not just to him, but coming from his own mind and his own words about his plans for America, and in particular, the exercise of power and authority that he plans to pursue if indeed we reelect him president of the United States of America. We know as well, we're going to focus on this in particular in this hour. We know as well that his campaign has also articulated, has put together a game plan, if you will. This is not a matter of surmise. This is not a matter of speculation about what a second term of Donald Trump in the presidency would mean, but rather this is a specific document. It's called Project 2025, a multi-page document identifying exactly how the president, the future president, if indeed it is Donald Trump, intends to exercise the authorities given to him under the Constitution of the United States of America. Important to understand that, not as a political matter, but as a governmental matter, as a rule of law matter, as a justice matter, when understanding the promises that he is making to increase presidential power in 2025 and beyond. And again, all of this coming out of a document that also embraces something called the unitary executive theory. We're going to talk about that in just a moment or so. The unitary executive theory that is encompassing this notion that, believe it or not, the president, according to this theory, according to Project 2025, this document coming out of the Trump campaign, that the president as it is, presidency as it is presently constituted, is not sufficiently powerful And of course, we pause right there. That is the predicate for many of these theories. The entire Constitution is premised upon the notion that the strongest branch, plainly envisioned by James Madison, George Mason, others, was going to be what? The legislative branch. That's Article 1, right? That's the legislature. Those are the voices of the people. Article 2 is the executive branch, the president. And Article 3, of course, is the judiciary, establishing the authority of the Congress to create such courts as it deems appropriate as our new nation back in 1789 and going forward is developed. Article 1 is the legislature. Article 2 in the Constitution, the presidency, the executive branch. Article 3, judges, federal judges. And so much of what the Trump campaign is articulating for our consumption, as I would offer as a civics matter, but also getting a sense of what a second Trump term would look like. All of this premised upon the notion fundamentally that there has been a diminution of the power of the executive over time, and all of these efforts in attempt to try to balance the scales, if you will, according to these reports and according to the aspirations in these documents to rebalance all of this in favor of a unitary executive with greater authority. In particular, Donald Trump and his allies are planning what can only be called a sweeping expansion of presidential power over the machinery of government. If, in fact, he is returned to the White House in 2025, it would basically reshape the structure of the executive branch to concentrate much greater authority and power and responsibility directly in the hands of the White House. These plans, again, a part of this thing called Project 2025. It is online. You can read it. You can acquire it. And take a look at the scope and the content of this plan for America. To centralize more power in the Oval Office, they stretch far beyond the complaints made by many presidents in the past about their incapacity to do things when Congress or sometimes the courts get in their way. And among other things, the past and perhaps future president has indicated along the way things that he will do. These are statements we're going to analyze in greater detail next week about his plans, for example, to order a criminal investigation into his present political rival. His name is Joe Biden, signaling his intent to end some of the post-Watergate norms of the Justice Department. When we come back, we're going to talk more about Project 2025 and all of these efforts underway now inside this campaign. Stay with us for that discussion.
The Tap.
Snow brings thoughts of ways to stay busy in Wisconsin during the winter. And if you anticipate hitting the slopes, are you surprised to learn there are more than 36 ski resorts across the state? It ranges from Wilmot Mountain, which opened in 1938 in Kenosha County, to Mount La Crosse Ski Area with one of the longest runs in Wisconsin. Granite Peak offers 58 runs outside Wausau, and Wild Mountain Ski Area and its 7 lifts near Hayward. Now, do you know which of those resorts sits on the highest slope? The answer coming up. Recreational skiing started in the Midwest. The Lost Ski Areas Project reports the first documentation of actual downhill skiers happened in Beloit in 1841. So which resort sits on the highest slope today? It's Granite Peak near Wausau and boasts 400 acres at a 700-foot vertical drop. The fun and history of skiing is a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
Texas Supreme Court is blocking a judge's ruling allowing an abortion for a pregnant woman whose fetus has a fatal diagnosis. The state has one of the nation's most restrictive abortion laws, but the ruling applied only to Kate Cox. Her lawsuit seeking the procedure says her baby is at high risk of stillbirth. Republican Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton says her case doesn't meet the criteria for a medical exception. KTVT-TV's Jack Fink.
Paxton sent a letter to Cox's doctor and three Houston hospitals Thursday saying the TRO will not insulate you or anyone else from civil and criminal liability for violating Texas's abortion laws, including first-degree felony prosecutions and civil penalties of not less than $100,000 for each violation. In response, the Center for Reproductive Rights, which represents Cox and her doctor, accused Paxton of fear-mongering. Quote, he is trying to bulldoze the legal system to make sure Kate and
we are back here on our Saturday morning broadcast talking about, through the rule of law lens, the justice lens, the legal lens, proposals coming out of the Trump campaign for a second Trump term in the White House, in particular focusing on this thing called Project 2025. It's a $22 million presidential transition document. Proposed the operational movement, again, from presumably from the Biden administration back to a Trump administration. All sorts of policies, practices, intentions for the governing authority of the president, and establishing, trying to reestablish, from the former president's view and perhaps the future president's view as well, reestablishing the great authority of the executive branch to act as it will under a thing called the unitary executive theory. Right before the break, talking about, for example, the connection between the White House and the Justice Department. As we have talked at great length on this broadcast and others as well, the huge importance that the Justice Department is not, in fact, beholden to the White House when it comes to the initiation of investigations, even special investigations, the initiation of charges, decisions about how to try cases. That necessarily needs to be at arm's length. A proposal coming out of this Project 2025 approach that would reestablish something that hasn't been in our nation since before Watergate, and that is having direct control and engagement by the White House in the activities, decision-making authorities, the prosecution movements of an attorney general. All of this, again, a part of plans for a second term in the White House. In addition to all of that, a major focus upon what's called an attempt to bring independent agencies under control. Things like the Federal Communications Commission, which, of course, makes and enforces rules for things like television and internet companies, things that have been much on the target, much among the discussion items by the former president in the present campaign. Things to try to rein in, if you will, the Federal Communications Commission, their words, not mine. Also, entities like the Federal Trade Commission. What does the FTC do? It enforces various antitrust and other consumer protection rules against businesses, bringing all those under direct presidential control in a way that they have not been. Again, to ensure that the executive branch has this great amount of authority when it comes to decision-making processes and the final decisions of those agencies. Along the way, something we'll talk about at greater length next time as well. The president, former president, wants to revive something called the practice of impounding funds. And again, goes back to the Constitution, right? How does appropriation work and where does money come from? We know that in the Constitution, the House of Representatives begins the budget process. It begins to put together a budget. Yes, under some statutes, the president also has an obligation to present an executive branch budget, but it comes out of the Congress. The Senate then reviews that. There's negotiation back and forth beyond the time that a budget then comes out of that process. President presumably would sign that in a time when we'd actually would have budgets. Right now, we're facing yet another budget concern and budget crisis coming up as soon as January. But that's the process, how it's supposed to happen. And the notion is there's that check and balance under the Constitution between the Congress and the White House. The Congress ultimately making decisions about how monies are spent, and the White House as the executive branch executing on those decisions by the Congress itself. That is why one of the present disputes between the Congress and the White House having to do with Ukraine funding is at the fore. This has to do with what the authority of the Congress is and the fact that the executive branch, the president right now, does not have the authority to allocate funds without supervision, without the concurrence, and without the direction of the legislative branch. The Project 2025 contemplates reviving this precedent of impounding funds, in particular, refusing to spend monies that Congress has appropriated for programs a president does not like. And that's a tactic that I indicated before. Lawmakers banned in the wake of the activities, the like activities of President Richard Nixon way back in the 1970s, an interest in, under this unitary executive theory, taking that authority and simply not appropriating, not using funds, not spending funds in a way that Congress has authorized. In addition, something we'll talk about more next time as well, intends to strip protections from tens of thousands of civil servants nationwide, making it much easier to replace them if they are deemed obstacles to that agenda. This, again, coming out of Project 25. There are civil servants in every single agency of our nation, and that includes the Department of Justice. I was one of those civil servants for about 25 of my 30 years with the Department of Justice before President Obama appointed me to serve as the U.S. Attorney in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. Civil servants every single day do the work and the mission and the focus of our government. We cannot get along without the civil servants, who are, again, not political people. They're not partisan in nature. They do their work according to what their commission is, according to what the assignments given to them are all about. And according to the Project 2025 dictates, the plan here is to scour the intelligence agencies as well, the State Department, defense bureaucracies as well, to remove officials who have been identified, again, according to the document, as the sick political class that hates our country. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. It has been my experience from 30 years in federal government, working not just for the Department of Justice, but engaging as the representative of all of those client agencies, that people in these agencies do their jobs thoughtfully. They come to work every day doing the work of government, tens of thousands of them. And the notion that somehow they should be shut down and their roles and their duties replaced with people who have partisan and political animus and partisan animation, simply anathema to what our country has been all about. Now, in that connection, we have talked already about this focus upon what's called the administrative state. And that's also a part of a lot of the articulated views coming out of Project 2025 and this notion of reestablishing a unitary executive theory. A lot of this has to do with what's really been a decades-long effort by some thinkers out there to undercut to what has been known as the administrative state. That's kind of the phrase that's been banding about a lot during our present campaigns. And that would be to address the ways in which the work of these agencies is being accomplished by these many, many civil servants doing their job every day. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the administrative state, so-called, the work of the Supreme Court right now, and what's called this unitary executive theory, all as a part of our examination this morning on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Wissota State Park and the Pablo Center. The entire Chippewa Valley is tapping in to the station talking about your hometown. 93.5 The Tap.
CBS News Brief. The Texas Supreme Court is putting a court ruling on hold that would have allowed Kate Cox, whose fetus has a fatal diagnosis, to get an abortion. CBS's Nicole Barker.
Cox says her doctors told her baby may not live longer than a week once born, and that her pregnancy complications could prevent her from having children in the future.
Now to the Israel-Hamas war, as the United States vetoes a UN Security Council demand for an immediate ceasefire. Robert Wood is a U.S. Deputy UN Ambassador.
Unfortunately, nearly all of our recommendations were ignored. And the result of this rushed process was an imbalanced resolution that was divorced from reality.
President Biden's son, Hunter, is now facing 9 new tax evasion indictments. Before that happened, he told a podcast critics are taunting him.
There is no doubt in my mind, and this may sound like some crazy hyperbole, is that they're trying to kill me through other means. And I just won't let them.
CBS News Brief.
Badgers volleyball team moves on to the Elite Eight. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Wisconsin Badgers women's volleyball team has had a great season, and now they're in the NCAA National Tournament. They beat Penn State 3-1 in front of over 7,000 at a sold-out packed UW Fieldhouse in Madison. Today, they face off against Oregon. The game's beginning at 7 o'clock. College basketball, the Wisconsin Badgers basketball team will take on the number one ranked team in the country, the Arizona Wildcats. That's this afternoon at 2:15 in Tucson. Wisconsin now ranked 23rd in the nation after beating Marquette and then Michigan State. They've come up a little short, though, in terms of points they could get from the free throw line. Head coach Greg Gard.
Getting there is probably priority number one. You know, we have to get there. You know, I'd like to get there 25-plus times a game. We were there. We did that against Northern Iowa. We got there a lot. You know, there's a lot of different ways to do that.
That's Wisconsin Badgers head coach Greg Gard. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, some snow is possible. Highs near 38 degrees. For tonight, snow likely, less than a half inch of accumulation. Breezy with a low around 23. Sunny for Sunday, 31. Sunshine and 35 on your Monday. For Tuesday, sunny and breezy, a high of 30.
Right now, 35.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes... Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station, the Devil's Advocates radio show.
Who's your Bob? Who's your daddy? What you got for us, Bob?
Look, you could dig Richard Nixon out of the ground right now, have him declare as a Democrat, and I would vote for him before I would vote for Donald Trump.
Dead Tricky Dick over Trump.
And I hate Richard Nixon.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show, weekday afternoons from 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Tell a friend what's on tap.
There's a new station in town with conversation about Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley.
This is 93.5 The Tap. Hey.
Different space. And we are back here in these final segments of our Saturday morning broadcast, talking this morning about this thing called Project 2025, an articulated examination, exposition of the plans of the Trump campaign of it for a second Trump candidacy. And specifically right before the break, talking about what is directly attacked inside this document and related documents prepared by the campaign, by speakers on behalf of the former and perhaps future president, and attack what's called the administrative state. And, of course, those are agencies that enact regulations. We know them well. You know all the names of them. They are aimed, for example, at keeping our air and our water clean, food, drugs, consumer products safe and secure, all those kinds of things, all sorts of regulations that are enacted by the Congress, rules implemented by the agencies to protect us, to keep us safe and secure. A focus on those administrative agencies throughout the government an attempt to bring them under the executive authority completely. No more discretion inside the agency actors, these civil servants who are out there designed and placed in these positions to keep us safe and secure and to do the work of these agencies without political focus and without partisan attention. All of this is also a part of this thing called the unitary executive theory, all much related to it. Now, what is that all about? Well, this legal theory rejects the idea that we talked about on many circumstances, under many cases, that the government is comprised of three separate branches and they overlap and they give powers of checks and balances to each. Instead, the notion of the unitary executive theory, which again is implicit in the words and the content and the meaning of this Project 2025 document, is that Article 2 of the Constitution, which establishes the executive branch, gives the president complete control of the executive branch. You may think, well, gee, of course that makes some sense, but that Congress cannot empower agency heads to make decisions or to restrict the president's ability to fire them. In other words, bringing under the executive branch all of the independent decision-making of many, if not all, of these agencies that are out there. That's the unitary executive theory, an attempt to, again, establish more power inside a unitary singular executive, not at all reflective of the balance of powers, the checks and balances in our Constitution, but implicit and explicit in this program, this identified document called Project 2025. The Reagan administration tried to use this concept in sort of a deregulatory agenda way back in the 1980s and going forward, pretty much unsuccessful. Other presidents, candidly, have been reluctant to abide by things that Congress has said, even sometimes federal agencies. But it's never reached this point. It's never reached the point where we're basically saying, as the president said in 2019, as the former president said in 2019, he said, I have an Article 2 where I have the right to do whatever I want as president. That's Donald Trump in 2019. He made the remark in reference to his claimed ability to fire Robert Mueller. Remember him? The fellow was investigating the Russia interference in the 2016 election. But he also tried to get a subordinate to have Mr. Mueller ousted, but was defied by that subordinate at the time inside the Department of Justice. Well, this concept, based upon this notion of establishing unitary authority inside the presidency, and also, as we'll talk next time, about filling all of these positions, or nearly all of them, with people who are partisan in nature and who are doing the political bidding of the president, that would undermine the Article 2 separation of powers between Article 1 and Article 3 as well. This entire idea that our agencies out there are not to be trusted, that the focus that they've been doing on behalf of our government is also finding its way and has found its way already into, yes, that's right, the United States Supreme Court. And we have talked about a series of cases that are already pending before the United States Supreme Court. Two of them already the subject of some significant oral arguments. A third one, a major case coming up in January, addressing this very issue of whether or not some of the independent federal agencies are truly independent, or whether or not this so-called administrative state of which they are allegedly a part, whether that should be deconstructed. And in fact, some of the deference given by federal judges to the agencies when it comes to federal law should be abandoned. Let's talk a little bit about some of those cases that we have, again, reviewed in the past and focused on in terms of underscoring the extent to which this concept of challenging and doubting the legitimacy of experts and agencies and relying instead upon others outside of those expertise areas, all of that anathema to our structure of government. We know that there have been three cases, as I said, in front of the Supreme Court right now pending. One of them is the CFPB versus Community Financial Services. That case was argued in the first day of the Supreme Court's present term, questioning whether or not the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau violates the Appropriations Clause of the Constitution by virtue of its funding, basically determining whether the CFPB, this agency put together after 2007, 2008, should remain in place. That issue before the Supreme Court, probably based upon the oral argument back in October, the Supreme Court probably unlikely to go along with this attack upon an agency, probably going to support the continued legitimacy of the CFPB. Not so much the SEC, and in a case called Securities and Exchange Commission versus Jarchese, argued just recently, November 29th, the United States Supreme Court entertaining very seriously whether or not the SEC, again, another one of these agencies out there, that whether it's been acting constitutionally based not only upon the commission given it way back in 1933, 1934, but also the untethered, as some people have said, notion that the SEC does not have direct oversight by the executive branch, and in particular, whether or not the SEC, by virtue of not granting jury trials to everybody who comes before the SEC, whether that renders the process by which the SEC has been doing its business unconstitutional. An attack upon the SEC pending before the United States Supreme Court right now. And in that argument, unlike the argument involving the CFPB, it appears, hard to say for sure, it appears that on November 29th, a majority, maybe, of the United States Supreme Court inclined to say that, yes, indeed, the SEC perhaps operating in a way that is unconstitutional for the past 90 years. But the big one coming up in mid-January, a case called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. And we have also talked about this case. Be fascinating to see what the United States Supreme Court does, how it weighs in on this broader issue about deference to and support of our federal agencies that are out there. Raimondo, interestingly, has to do with a challenge to a decision by something called the National Marine Fisheries Service's interpretation of a fishing regulation about some compliance monitors and who pays for them. That's the underlying case. That's the underlying facts that gives rise to this particular case. But the larger issue there is whether or not a 40-year tradition by our federal judiciary deferring to federal agencies, the experts, as I've said before, the scientists, yes, the marine fishery people, but also the mathematicians, the engineers, the medical staff, the nurses, the doctors, the educators, the bankers, the economists, all the people who know what they're talking about inside our federal agencies, inside the Department of Agriculture and Labor, and Commerce, and yes, Department of Justice as well, every single agency out there, independent or inside the cabinet, whether or not the deference that has traditionally been given to those decisions by the experts inside those agencies should continue under a doctrine called the Chevron Doctrine. It comes out of a case of 40 years ago and basically says that when the Congress passes a law that's not entirely clear, that has perhaps an omission about its operation or its conduct, the federal courts, for the most part, should defer to the people who know what they're talking about when it comes to interpreting the law and understanding what the particular law, how it should be interpreted going forward. That's the Chevron Doctrine that has animated federal courts for 40 years. And the question coming up before the Supreme Court in mid-January in this Loper Bright Enterprises cases versus Raimondo, taking a page out of this attack on the administrative state, this notion that there is a unitary executive that should, in fact, be responsible for all the decision-making, and that, in fact, you can even replace some of those experts and some of those civil servants who are there, the doctors, the scientists, the mathematicians, and so forth, with people who have a partisan view, a political view that would be animated by the agenda of the White House, whoever occupies that. That doctrine is on the chopping block coming up in January in this case called Raimondo. We need to watch very carefully what the Supreme Court says about that, how the present members of the Supreme Court react to that when they hear that case in mid-January. And of course, we're going to be on the air at about the same time talking with you about that. The reason I bring all this up, these three cases, Raimondo and SEC versus Jarchese and the CFPB case, those are three cases that are right now pending before our United States Supreme Court that, depending upon how the court decides them, could embrace in large ways, in medium ways, or in small ways, the very things that are being articulated, at least in part, in this Project 2025, that articulates this view that there is a unitary executive that can, in fact, and should, in fact, be authorized to do these intrusions into these agencies, substituting the decisions of these agencies for executive branch views. Now, there are plainly views across the board. You know that Steve Bannon, early on in the Trump presidency, promised a deconstruction of the administrative state. That's exactly what he is talking about. And, of course, there are others who have said the same kinds of things, even in the recent campaign, bringing the independent agencies under the thumb, if you will, of a second Trump White House. There are, at the same time, those folks who are out there, including people from the former Trump campaign and the former Trump administration, who have recoiled in abject disbelief about these kinds of things. People on all sides of political aisle who likewise look at this and say, no, indeed, this is unconstitutional. We know, for example, that the former chief of staff inside the presidency, John Kelly, said, who was the second chief of staff, he said, all of this would be chaotic. It would just simply be chaotic because he'd, meaning the new president, former president returned, would be trying to exceed his authority in the White House. But the sycophants, he said, would go along with it. It would be a nonstop gunfight between the Congress and the courts. That by John Kelly, the former chief of staff, arguing against this notion in Project 2025, this unitary executive theory that has a positing in the White House of super authority in a new campaign underway now, a new presidency that could, in fact, be in place in January 2025. We have some callers on the line to talk with me about all this. Delighted to have you with us. Let's begin with you, Joe, in Madison. Glad to have you with us this morning, Joe.
I very much look forward to next week, and I appreciate the fact that you've allowed us to kind of preview what we've got here. There are a couple of things that I'm you maybe don't have to go into today, but I would love to have you look at in this next time, two things that come apart that are really important for me. First off, sort of historically, especially because of the influence of the progressive movement in our state and Robert La Follette,
yes,
and what that meant in terms of having a government where you simply put in your pals, the people that you like and that, you know, that are going to be your good dogs and not to get out of line, as compared to civil service and the importance of what the civil service meant. And in terms of, you know, even a civil service exam saying that you are qualified for your particular position, I take great concern over the issue of possibly scouring intel agencies, especially thinking of the institutional knowledge that people have and that would go away if you just put your pals in there. And then the last thing that I would say is, you know, this notion of the president refusing to spend money that has been allocated by Congress. We're kind of at dictator status there, aren't we? If Congress decides, for example, to put flood controls of a certain sort in the Mississippi River and the president just decides, no, you're not going to get it, or the Congress decides we're going to apportion money for help in elections and the president just says, no, you're not going to get it. Those are the sorts of questions I would love to hear you go into in more detail, but particularly looking at this issue of the progressives and the notion that you need to have some knowledge about what you're doing if you're in EPA or the intel agencies or FCC or whatever it may be, in order to do the best possible job. That knowledge matters. And
absolutely, Joe. And again, you've hit the nail right on the head. That is exactly what this is about. And the focus, once again, on the experts who are inside these agencies. When we come back after this break into our final segment, I'm going to respond more, Joe, to your very good question, your thought there, and then talk.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
When I first had my baby, I'd get comments all the time about how happy I must be. I remember thinking, I want to be happy. Why don't I feel that way? It was hard to admit that, even to my doctor. But I'm glad I did. She told me it was postpartum depression, and that is very treatable. These days, things are feeling good, and we're both happier about that. Right, little man? I'll take that as a yes.
Mental health care is working for Simone. See what it can do for you at mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
Latrell spent more than 8 years in foster care. His world changed when he was adopted at 15 with help from the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption.
I think about how much we love him, and I wish we could have had him for his entire childhood.
The Foundation is changing the lives of thousands of teens waiting in foster care. You can help. Learn more at DaveThomasFoundation.org.
93.5 The Tap.
And we are back, and this is our final segment right before the break. Joe asking us this very good question about civil service and why those people who take these civil service jobs often, yes, that's exactly right, after taking a civil service examination to determine whether or not you are indeed qualified, if you can, in fact, if not be an expert, at least acquire the expertise over time to work in these various agencies. These are, as I've said repeatedly this morning, the people who know what they're doing. Are they infallible? Absolutely not. Are agencies ones who always make the right decisions? No, and that's why we've got administrative processes inside these agencies, Joe, which you implicitly suggested, to contest the decisions of whether or not the SEC, the CFPB, other agencies out there, including agencies like the Social Security Administration, Housing and Urban Development, Health and Human Services, all the agencies out there that are responsible for administrating government, you can go and you can contest the decisions made by those folks, their administrative procedures. The issue here, again, number one, is ensuring that the people who are making those decisions in the first place have the expertise. And indeed, that notion of civil servants, my experience, as I have said, is that for the most part, not universally, but for the most part, they are hugely competent. They want to do good jobs. They do those jobs, whether or not the president is of one party or another. I happen to have served under 7 Republican attorneys general, 2 Democratic attorneys general, and I can tell you from that 30-year experience that we do not sit around inside the Department of Justice and determine whether or not a president's political agenda anticipates or calls for a particular prosecution or a particular kind of civil litigation. That simply doesn't happen. We make decisions based upon the rule of law and justice. And Joe, that's what you're focusing on, this notion of civil servants who are doing their jobs competently. And that's why, depending upon how far this is pushed, this unitary executive theory, the notion of replacing many, if not all, of those people with partisan actors is so problematic. And to your point, Joe, contrary to our Constitution, it really is something that is not only not contemplated by our Constitution, but we read the Federalist Papers. These are exactly the kinds of things that were intended by our founding fathers, even though they could not possibly have envisioned the agencies that we have today. Still, Congress created these specialized agencies throughout our history, plainly, inside the executive branch and some outside, and delegated to them, undeniably, some of its powers to make rules and to make decisions under those rules. But along the way, it did so on the express condition that it was not simply handing off that power to presidents, as one of the judges has recently said, presidents wielding that authority to act like kings. That's why you've got judicial review. That's why you've got administrative decision-making going on a regular basis. Putting commissioners atop of them, whom presidents appoint but generally cannot fire before their terms end. The whole idea behind that is a check and balance to ensure that the presidency, powerful though it is, does not have the authority to invest inside those agencies' political or partisan viewpoints. That's what these cases are all about. And of course, there are checks and balances, as I've indicated, judicial appeals to the courts. We see those routinely. That's what those 3 cases involving the Supreme Court right now are all about. They come from administrative agencies, and they're going to be determined by courts, lower courts, now the highest court in the land, not without review. But the notion, once again, pursuant to this unitary executive theory and Project 2025, that you need to rebalance all of this to bring all of these civil servants or majority of them inside the executive branch, simply contrary to what our tradition has been. So, Joe, appreciate that as a huge amount. We'll be also talking about this impounding concept later on in our second broadcast next week. Again, something that's contrary in many ways to what we have done in history, certainly recently, in the wake of Watergate. That was a common practice by Richard Nixon and perhaps even prior presidents. No more, not a good time to return to that because, again, it is contrary to the fundamental tenets in our Constitution that do what? The Congress sets the budget. The president executes it. And there can be disputes about how that execution takes place, but that's the process by which it is done. And, yes, from time to time, the courts get involved in that as well. Got another call on the line. Mark, glad to have you with us this morning as we talk all about these important issues related to rule of law and the administration of our executive agencies in government in 2023 and beyond. Mark, go ahead with your question or comment.
Yeah, thanks. And as someone who was a civil servant for my career with the DNR.
Good for you. Good for you.
And you do your job, and that, you know, and I was a professional, you know, did the civil service exam and got the job and did it to the best of my ability. And what gets me is this is ignoring our history, because the civil service system we have today has part of its genesis in the assassination of a president, John Garfield, who was assassinated by a disappointed office seeker. I mean, the concept that the president can put all these little lackeys in to do whatever he wants. I mean, and these guys are, what's remarkable, these guys are telling us out loud what they want to do. They right. want to bring down the United States and turn us into what we see Vladimir Putin doing over in Russia, because Putin speaks and somebody, you know, flies out a window. I mean, that it is just, is that what they want to see in this country? Because I can envision that happening with a man like Donald Trump and his sycophants like Steve Bannon and these other criminals who he pardoned on his way out the door, and people who committed treason like General Flynn, who betrayed the United States and Trump pardoned him.
And all of that, Mark, again, let's unpack a couple of things you already said there. First of all, you're the perfect example of, and again, there are tens of thousands of Marks out there, both in the state system and the federal system, who, as you just said, you go to work every morning and probably stay late into the night, often weekends, working very hard on behalf of people. The unseen people who make government work, state actors, federal actors, local actors as well, municipal people who are doing their jobs. They may, in fact, take direction, supervision from, yes, political people. There's no doubt that the members of the cabinet, for example, in the federal system are appointed by the president, subject to Senate confirmation. But inside the Department of Transportation, inside the Department of Commerce and Labor and Agriculture and all these others, the thousands of people, and yes, it is a big group out there, those numbers of people who are out there, nonetheless, important people in making our government work. And when we come back next week, we're going to talk more about this issue that Mark has just raised about people, personnel, as a part of this Project 2025. We're inviting you to come back again next Saturday for that discussion, again, focusing upon the rule of law and the aspiration for justice in our nation. Thanks for joining me, everybody. Have a good week.
It's better this way. We'd hurt each other with the things we want to say.
Tapped in to the issues affecting the Valley and all of Wisconsin.
Consider us the bartenders of friendly local talk.
This is 93.5 The Tap. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
One in four Americans today are living with a disability. I'm one of them. People with disabilities are extremely talented, resilient problem solvers that have so much to offer. And we've got a trusted ally on our side, an organization we can rely on, Easter Seals. Easter Seals is leading the way to full equity, inclusion, and access to healthcare, employment, and education for people with disabilities, families, and communities. That's my Easter Seals. Make it yours.
Learn more and get involved at EasterSeals.com.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.